The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, each year we do the Best Of show as a wrap-up to the year, going back and just looking at some of the guests that we've had through the last year.
Kevin, the challenge is to pick the ones that represent the highlights, because I look at this last year as an absolutely epic year. We had Jim Rogers, Richard Duncan, Giulio Gaurotti, Don McIlvaney, Cameron Beccari with Stratfor, Stephen Roach, Harold James, Jerome Corsi, Martin Jakes, the Aiden sisters, Greg Weldon.
Otmar Issing.
Yeah. Hernando de Soto joined us again.
Right.
It's just a fabulous year for us to continue to explore ideas which we think are relevant to a financial thesis and the factors that are impacting that, whether that's economic issues, financial issues, political issues, geopolitical issues, or as they bleed into each category and cross over. We've had some of the best experts in the country and around the world adding to our thought process.
Well, you know, David, we've tried to point out that things move from the financial to the economic to the political to the geopolitical. And actually, just why don't we start out with the first clip, John Embry talking about the financial.
Kevin, what we're going to do today is just look at a few highlights. So without a lot of fanfare or introduction to each, just letting you know who the person is, who the guest was that's speaking, and if you'd like to go back and listen to the entirety of that program, and we'll give you the date that it was programmed as well. So, Kevin, this first interview is March 4th, 2010, with John Embry. Well, if Bernanke and Geithner are bending the laws of economic physics, if you will, can you say that there are still some immutable laws in economics?
The one immutable law to me is that once you have a broken credit cycle, all the king's horses and all the king's men aren't going to be able to put it back together again. You just can't do the same thing over again. It's over, and it's going to take a long period of repair to get sort of the economy in position to grow in a sustainable manner.
It doesn't seem like our leadership are seeing that we are at the end of that cycle or that it's broken.
Our leadership likes to get elected. That's the problem, and they can't tell the public the truth because I think the public's starting to figure it out on their own, and that's why you're seeing this unrest in these tea parties and what have you. But we're in a very tough situation here because basically we're being told that, you know, the economy's improving and things are going to just continue to get better, and we don't see any evidence of that. In fact, some of the numbers coming out in the United States recently have been, I would consider, sort of supportive of a double dip very shortly.
It looks to me like the crux, looking ahead to 2010 and 2011, the crux of the matter is in the treasury market and the bond market. We've got the Chinese who were net sellers of treasuries by about $9.3 billion last year. They're making major moves to liquidate Freddie and Fannie paper, the agency paper, in earnest. Maybe you could connect some of the dots. By the way, the Chinese liquidations are not just an asset allocation shift, but it is politically and geopolitically charged. Maybe you could connect some of the dots between bond market funding issues, perhaps a failed treasury auction, the quantitative easing, which is supposed to end here in just a few weeks, inflation, the dollar, the price of gold. Dive in where you wish.
Well, you know, I think the proposition that quantitative easing is going to end anytime soon is absolutely not on. I believe that there is no choice unless they're prepared to take a horrific deflationary collapse almost, that they have to continue with quantitative easing for the very same reasons you just mentioned. The fact is that the sovereign or the governments have stepped in to replace the demand in the economy to the extent possible where the private sector is withdrawn. And in so doing, they are running up horrific budget deficits. It's just not the United States. You can go all over the world and look at this. And very simply, there aren't enough savings in the world to fund these sovereign debt. So the next major crisis, by extension, obviously, is the sovereign debt crisis. And to me, the only basic way to sort of deal with it in the short run is quantitative easing, ergo monetization, the government's printing up the money to buy the debt.
I have a few questions for you on the gold market.
Sure.
There's so many pundits on CNBC and CNFN who've argued that gold is in a bubble and it's overpriced. And do you disagree with this? And what does a bubble look like if you do disagree with that?
Well, I violently disagree with it in the sense that the first thing you need for a bubble is wide public participation and belief. I can guarantee you can go up to the average citizen and 80% of them don't even know what gold is other than it's in jewelry. And secondly, I mean, if you really thought the gold price was too high, the obvious corollary would be that gold companies would be making a fortune. None of them are making any money at all to speak of. So, I mean, the idea that the gold's in a bubble is, to me, the most preposterous thing on the planet. The one thing that's in a bubble is the creation of fiat money. I mean, gold is the one that should be in the bubble. And it was interesting, George Soros made that comment about gold is the ultimate bubble, which was misconstrued by a lot of people. He didn't say it was the ultimate bubble right now. He said it's going to be, if you read it closely. It will be the ultimate bubble, and we're still a long way away from that.
Well, and just to support what you said in terms of the interpretation of that statement, he made a huge commitment to the gold market just in recent months. So, yes, it's in the greatest bubble of all time, and that's why I'm buying. No, I think you're exactly right. He's saying it will ultimately be one of the world's greatest bubbles.
So I have the one advantage. So many great advantages to being old, but one is that you have seen it before. And when my experience in the 70s, I got involved with gold early in the 70s. It was the same kind of frustrating trip through most of the decade. And then at the end, the real gold fever hit. And I mean, gold moved from about $250 to $850 in probably a year and a half or less. And you see, we haven't seen that phase at all. This has been a really labored rise. The gold price has gone up for 9 consecutive years. And yet, the maximum rise in any year was 31%. It's been very contained.
Well, Kevin, now we have the advantage of time having passed since that early March interview. And in retrospect, we can look at John's call that gold would be, as he wrote in January, expect gold to gain more than 30% this year. He has been on practically to the number. Are we 28.5 or will we finish at 31.5 by the end of the year? We're right there, Kevin.
It was very accurate. Well, that's true, Dave. John Embry was very accurate on that prediction. Well, the very next week, March 10th, we had one of our favorite guests on, Russell Napier.
What we'll do today, Kevin, is look at several things with Russell that I think are particularly helpful in regards to capital controls, in regards to the sovereign debt market, in regards to the equity market, and in the larger context, because again, this goes back to two interviews we've had with him in the past. Russell Napier wrote this book, The Anatomy of the Bear, in 2004, and in it, he says, ultimately, we will find the kinds of values we had in 1921, 32, 49, in 1982, which is equity selling at rock bottom prices. How do we get there, and what does it look like between here and there? That's what we're going to explore today as we look at, is that a two-year process? Is that a six-month process? Is that a six-year process? Where are we at, and where are we going?
Well, and of course, Russell Napier probably has spent thousands of hours researching, you know, his book, The Anatomy of the Bear, just looking at those four bear market bottoms over the last 100 years. Let's go ahead and go to Russell right now.
Russell, in past conversations, we've discussed Tobin's Q as a valuation of a company's assets at a replacement value. Four times in a 100-year period, that value's reached a 70% discount to replacement value. And each of these periods was a remarkable time to have bought equities in retrospect. So we are currently in the context of a secular bear market, as I understand. And your book, The Anatomy of the Bear, pointed out that bear markets tend to last about 14 years. That would take us, what, to about 2014. Is there some guidance that you'd like to add, what the next couple of years look like, and then perhaps what the end game, taking us to 2014, might include as well?
I think when anybody makes a forecast, there's some things you can be more certain of than others. So the fact that we have to go back to a low valuation on the measure you mentioned, Q, but also the cyclically adjusted PE, which I mentioned in the book, I'm reasonably certain that it's just the dynamic of the marketplace that has to happen. 2014 is more of a guess based on average length, and therefore it's a dangerous forecast. However, the more important bit is to work out what the catalyst is, because if you begin to see that happening, then you think this is the sort of thing that can produce a really, really cheap equity market and significant material losses for those who hold on the way. So as this crisis has evolved, it's become more and more obvious that the crisis that would afflict equities and bring them to their lows again is going to be something of a sovereign debt crisis. the crisis we've just seen was a classic market crisis. Supply outstripped demand. Prices began to fall, began to bankrupt people, whether it was people who were borrowed against housing or people who had borrowed from various businesses. And that would be a classic overproduction, deflationary, depressionary bust. But of course, the governments wouldn't accept it, refused to let it happen, and instead have put their own credit quality on the line. And if you look at any projection from the Congressional Budget Office or any other developed world country, you'll see how this takes us into severe fiscal problems very quickly. And therefore, I think it'll be a sovereign debt crisis, rising yields in government bonds, which will reduce the next crisis. And as you just said, it's not just a supply-side issue that the governments will be issuing more. A real problem will be that sometime in the next few years, we're likely to see the Chinese move to a much more flexible exchange rate. And that's going to create huge problems for the demand for U.S. treasuries as well. So 2014 is still as reasonable, I guess, as any. But I think your listeners will find it more useful to try and look out for what catalyst could do that. And because the governments won't let the market forces do it, I'm afraid we won't have creative destruction in the private sector. We might have to have creative destruction of the public sector.
Okay, and then David, taking us into April 28th, 2010, we interviewed Harold James.
Kevin, today we've got the second part of the interview with Harold James. We talked about several elements from one of his books, but actually all of his books are highly recommended. The End of Globalization, Lessons from the Great Depression, that's about a 10-year-old book, and then what he published this last year, The Creation and Destruction of Value. Mm-hmm. That was an office read for us. Everyone in our company has read it and studied through it, and we've had it intense discussion over it, which was fantastic. He's also written The Roman Predicament, How the Rules of International Order Create the Politics of Empire. Mm. We have him as a part of the conversation because he brings a historical depth and an insight as a historian and professor of international relations at Princeton that I think are telling, and you definitely get that in reading his books. You say on page 277, the only way of dealing with the collapse in values is to rebuild values. Regaining trust is a long and arduous process. That is why, when globalization is broken, it's not easy to put together again. We'll look for communities of virtue, but inevitably we will not find them at once, and the globalization cycle will resume, but not immediately. You have been a student of modern history, taught at many universities. Your professional experience in intellectual rigor speaks for itself in the books that you've written. As you spend time in Europe, as you spend time here in the United States on occasion as well, would you reflect with us on what you hope and what you likely see over the next 3 or 4 or 5 years? What's your most realistic view of where we're going?
I believe if you think we're this medium-term horizon, not what's going to happen tomorrow, not what's going to happen in 20 or 50 years' time. But the foreseeable future is, I think, going to be actually rather a bleak one. The sense of an imminent collapse pulling governments and politicians together in order to deal with it is going to go away. But we're going to be just dealing with the aftermath of the crisis with poor economic growth for some time and really an increase in distrust, an increase in anger, resentment, alienation. So the short-term, medium-term for me is really on the whole not a very happy one just at the moment.
Kevin, the next interview was with Stephen Roach in early June, June 9th, and it was a fantastic discussion.
David, today the question is Asia, especially China, but India as well. Why right now are we focusing our interest on China and India or Asia in general?
Well, Kevin, it's a thematic that we've been thinking about for a long time and we'll continue to explore in terms of different aspects and elements between now and the end of the year, whether it's the political, geopolitical, military elements or the financial and economic. Today we have Stephen Roach joining us. He's the chairman of Morgan Stanley Asia, and in my younger years at Morgan Stanley, he was a major influence for me as I read everything that he published as their chief economist before he transitioned to his Asia post 3 years ago. Kevin, we're going to draw from the midpoint of our discussion with Stephen Roach, where we're talking about central bank liquidity and many of the other issues affecting Asia today.
Let me just state at the outset and answer your question that liquidity injections from central banks really can't solve anything. All they can do is give you a window of time to adjust or to put in a downside against an deflationary risk and bring crises to an end, or if there's an inflation problem and the monetary policy needs to be tight, they can address the excesses of overheated economies. But the big problems are structural. In the case of China, I think it requires a very different approach to stimulate internal private consumption. And that approach, I think, needs to address three key issues in the structure of the Chinese economy. Number one, excess savings. Chinese households save to excess. By one measure, the household savings rate in China was 27.5% in the year 2000, and according to the flow of funds statistics, 37.5% in the year 2008. This is a saving excess engendered by fear, by insecurity. It was a huge increase in precautionary saving by Chinese families. They don't have a social safety net. And so to compensate for that, they need to invest heavily in social security, private pensions, unemployment insurance, medical insurance. If China does that, then I think that some of that fear can be redressed and household savings rate can start stabilizing. Secondly, China needs to address its lagging rural income problems. Over 800 million Chinese still live at relatively impoverished levels in the rural countryside, and their incomes have been lagging those in coastal China, in urban China. And this is very much at odds with what the Chinese leaders and the Chinese Communist Party aspires to take a more egalitarian form, the so-called harmonious society, as it's referred to in China. And to address this, you need policy to aggressively support rural income through tax rebates, through rural land reform, through IT-enabled connectivity of agricultural communities, and through aggressive incentives to stimulate rural-urban migration. And finally, China needs new sources of job creation. And this is primarily going to take place in the services economy, stimulating labor-intensive service industries that are really far too small in China today. Industries in the wholesale and retail trade area, leisure and hospitality, domestic transportation, supply chain logistics, finance, healthcare. And if China does that, it can come up with new sources of job creation to also stimulate private purchasing power. These are all policies that China can accomplish and begin to move ahead on, I think, a relatively short period of time.
Well, it's interesting you describe liquidity injections by central bankers as being only a temporary fix. Monetary authorities can create money, but they can't necessarily direct its flow. And so we have sort of these unstable thematics that develop on the other side of liquidity injections as asset bubbles are created. It seems to be the history of the U.S. It seems that there is a bubble forming in China as a result of most of your credit creation of the last year or two, maybe a few years more than that, going into urban construction. It's not really that widely dispersed. I mean, you just described three structural things that need to take place. Are they taking place? Is the social safety net being developed? How do you move towards a service-oriented economy? It took us, 40 or 50 years to accomplish that here in the United States. Is that perhaps why you're describing it as the next Asia? Not necessarily the Asia of today, but what needs to be and what could be a success story in Asia, but it's not our current context.
Well, the next Asia is very much premised on the transition from a system driven by external demand to one driven by internal demand, and the Chinese consumer is a critical piece in that equation. The general notion when I talk about this around the world is that it's going to take a long, long time. I would say two things in response to this. Number one, because of the here and now of external demand shocks, China does not have a long, long time. This is not going to be, they can't afford to make this as drawn out a process as the manufacturing-led development of the last 30 years was, unless they're prepared to take a major growth shortfall arising from a weaker external growth environment. Number two, I've learned in the years I've been focusing on China, never underestimate the determination of the Chinese authorities and their still centrally planned economy to push through dramatic change and to accomplish tough objectives in short periods of time. China operates on the basis of a five-year planning cycle. The next five-year plan, which would be the 12th five-year plan, is due to be enacted by the National People's Congress in February of 2011. That's only 9 months away. We'll get some hints as to where they're headed, really, by the end of this year. This will be the last five-year plan of the current leadership headed up by President Hu Jintao and Premier Wen Jiabao. I do believe that this is going to be an aggressive five-year plan that does go after dealing with the excesses of saving, lagging rural incomes, and services-led job creation. I think there are pieces of this plan that can be accomplished in a short period of time, but I think the transition is going to have a long tail to it. The challenge for China is just to move the needle away from external toward internal demand. I honestly do think that important progress in these areas can be accomplished in a short period of time.
David, many times to bring clarity to things that you're asking, questions that you're trying to answer, you're actually traveling. You traveled a lot this last year.
Kevin, between Switzerland, between Brussels, Paris, Mexico City, throughout Asia, the Middle East, we were on the road a lot this year.
Well, and you know, David, you went to Israel in June. The June 16th, 2010 show was very interesting because of what was going on there at the time. On the phone with us today is David McElvaney in Israel. In fact, David, I think you're in Jerusalem right now, are you not?
Kevin, I'm in Jerusalem. I'm sitting just outside the old city walls, and I've been here for a couple of days. The group that we were with, this was an interesting kind of tour, and I say that in quotes because for anyone who has been to Israel on a tour, you've probably been to sites and seen lots of things. This was more about meeting people and
right.
getting an insight into what's happening in the Middle East. We met with current state officials, retired state officials. From an earlier commentary with Yehuda Avner, we had dinner with Yehuda Avner and his wife, and it's been an absolutely fascinating series of days in terms of the meetings, the discussions, the questions asked, the possible solutions offered. This was a very unique group. Israel Bonds is the group which globally raises funds for infrastructure projects in Israel. On a different note, it was interesting. Russia plays more largely in the picture globally and here locally every day. It's very ambiguous. In front of the UN Security Council and publicly, Russia is talking about Israel. It's very ambiguous what their position is. It's very ambiguous what their position on Iran is. Behind closed doors, they are less cagey and more direct about their position, which is that Iran will not end up with weapons of mass destruction or nuclear weapons. But this is interesting, Kevin, because here we have world politics, world geopolitics being remade in a post-Cold War era. And this is something that came up with another gentleman we had breakfast with. I won't mention him by name, but that Israel, at a popular level, is considering all options, not necessarily at a political level or an administrative level, but at a popular level, people are saying, if America won't support us, who will? And Russia comes right to the fore. That may be because there's a new million-plus population from Russia and certainly familiarity with the culture, language, etc. But I think to assume that in a post-Cold War era, all alliances remain just as they were 20 years ago would be a mistake and naive. The world is going to get more complex when it comes to geopolitics and less black and white, perhaps more pragmatic. So we will see.
Before we finish, Dave, I would really like to have you tell the listeners about your tunnel tour today and just the impressions that you had, because you've been to Israel many times, but the depth of the impression that you brought back this time or that you're bringing back this time, I think there's a real, you know, word picture or metaphor that can give the nature of what Israel really is today.
Kevin, we had on as a guest several months ago, historian from Princeton, Harold James, and one of his comments was that we need to find and explore a deeper history. And I've been here five times before. This is my sixth trip to Israel. And I've seen the old city before, and I've traveled the countryside before. And having a sense of place and of the power of what has happened in this place, the seat of Western culture largely, and in the seat of all three monotheistic religions, This is a very immensely important place in the world. And yet, when I look at the old city tonight, Kevin, the sun has just set, and I look at the old city, what I realize is that there's onion layers of complexity at every level, politically, religiously, socially, archaeologically. And what you look at on the surface in terms of archaeology is from the 18th century. And you can go to certain parts of the city, and it's from the 14th century. And you dig a little deeper, and there's stuff from the 12th century. And then you dig a little deeper, and there was the reconstructed city under the Muslim in between the 7th and 8th century. And you dig deeper still, and today was a tunnel tour through and by the Western Wall, not through, rather, but next to, adjacent to the Western Wall. And these are the building blocks of Jerusalem going back 2,000 years. Some of the areas, they would argue, go back to the First Temple period, which would have been 2,800 years ago, Kevin. And what it did, Kevin, is it shattered my perspective in time. You assume, maybe this is a distinctly American perspective, with buildings that go back, the old ones, date back to the 1700s. And here is a place that is decidedly and historically Jewish going back 3,000 years. And to touch the stones which the Romans could not destroy. There was one stone in this tunnel, Kevin, that was 40 feet long, roughly 12 feet high, and 8 feet deep, 15 feet deep. And this was a massive stone, Kevin, moved by Herod over 2,000 years ago. And the Romans leveled this city. They leveled it. And this was all that remained. But the city's been rebuilt and destroyed, and rebuilt and destroyed, and rebuilt and destroyed. And with every destruction and with every rebuilding comes a new complexity in terms of the sociological dimensions, the ownership entitlement, the political complexity, the religious nuance and sacredness of space. So it really is, Kevin, to me, a great picture for us as thinkers in the modern world of the need for a deeper history.
Well, David, about 3 weeks after that interview with you in Israel, we interviewed Kamran Bokhari on July 7th, 2010, who's a Middle Eastern expert.
It may seem like an odd topic for a financial organization to look at seriously, you know, perhaps as an emerging market investment theme, or if you're looking at growth rates, demographics, you know, is it going to be included in the euro? Does that mean significant growth? Our approach, frankly, is a little bit different. We place as much value on the risk variables in an investment thesis, or in this case, in the larger context of investing, as we emphasize the potential growth opportunities. So none of the emerging market investment themes are to us as remotely important as observing a shift, and perhaps a radical shift over time, which takes a longtime ally, Turkey and the United States, to actually being inclined to support our enemies abroad, or perhaps even become one. I mean, could we lose a significant ally, perhaps the most significant ally, through neglect or through bad foreign policy? And what are the consequences of that? The context of the Middle East, Kevin, is an important one to grasp. There are countless ramifications into the investment markets. Gold, silver, oil, natural gas, the stability of Europe. You've got a significant amount of Russian oil that flows through the Bosporus Strait, right in between the two halves of Istanbul. I mean, when you look at the map, it begins to be very clear how significant Turkey is from an economic, geostrategic standpoint.
And there seems to be a shift right now in alliances. That's one of the reasons for the show today.
Yeah, exactly. Just to explore in a different geopolitical context, are we watching our ally, Turkey, shift away from westernization and what for the last 100 years has been a moderate secular state, and perhaps shift back to a historical identity? The last great Islamic empire, the seat of the caliphate for more than 400 years. I mean, if we lose a friend, we certainly don't want to see them become an enemy.
As you mentioned, the end of the Cold War essentially altered the architecture in which regional states fell in line. The world was much more black and white back then. You had the Western camp, and you had the pro-Soviet states. With that dissolving, with the implosion of the Soviet Union and the fall of communism, things have become much more messy. It's no coincidence that we see a U.S.-Iraqi conflict very early on, pretty much at about the same time we see the Soviet Union falling. We see a U.S.-Iraqi confrontation taking place, particularly with the Ba'athist regime of President Saddam Hussein, former President Saddam Hussein, and we see a long struggle in which the regime was badly hit with the 91 war, and we see a slow decline of that entity, which was a major player in the region. And at about the same time, Iran, which was a regional rival to Iraq, given the eight-year war in the 80s, begins to recalculate and consider other opportunities that it didn't have in the previous decade. Likewise, Turkey is undergoing an internal metamorphosis in which there is a struggle intensifying between conservative forces or Islamist forces and then the Kemalist establishment. So all of this becomes much more prominent because of the absence of the overall threat from the Soviets. So when that threat was no longer, then we have the regional states as well as the United States and its European allies taking a much more relaxed, nuanced approach to the region where they were not confined by the logic of the Cold War and the need to have allies to contain the Soviets. So in other words, it becomes much more complex. And if we fast forward to 2003, we see that the United States in the post-September 11 age moves to effect regime change in Iraq, which essentially reshapes the entire balance of power. There are essentially two balances of power that have existed during the post-World War II age. One was the Arab-Israeli balance, which was always, you know, in favor of Israel because the Arab states were never unified and they didn't have a common position, though they've tried in multiple instances in history, but they all failed. The other balance of power was between Iran and Iraq, which despite the eight-year war, pretty much held together. It really took a hit when the United States and Iraq went to war in 91, and then effectively it became non-existent in 2003. In other words, the Ba'athist Leviathan that blocked the path of the Persians, the Islamic Republic of Iran, was no longer there. And so no longer do you have a threat. From the Iranian point of view, they did away with a threat and created an opportunity, the opportunity being the increase of influence because of the demographic structure of Iraq. Some 60% of Iraq is Shia with very close ties to Iran. In fact, it would not be an exaggeration to say that all the political principles of the Iraqi Shiite are in to varying degrees connected to the political establishment in Tehran. And thus we see the U.S.-Iranian struggle since 2003 in trying to shape the future post-Ba'athist Iraq. At the same time, we see just months before the United States invades Iraq and then effects regime change there, we see the rise of the current ruling party in Turkey, the Justice and Development Party. And very early on, that government refuses to join the war effort and Parliament rejects it and then creates sort of, if you will, a friction between Washington and Ankara. Washington wanted Turkish support for the war effort. The Turks did not agree. And we see the first stirrings of Turkey trying to actually stand on its own and move away from that idea that it is just another member of the West, a fellow NATO ally. We see under the AKP, the Justice and Development Party government, a move to bring Turkey into being much more than just being a fellow NATO ally and an aspirant to join the European Union.
Kevin, on July 14th of this year, we had a program where we talked about municipal bonds, mortgage-backed securities, and some anecdotal things that we were observing as we were at a conference in Las Vegas.
Okay, so that's real estate, but you did mention municipal bonds and treasuries earlier. What's your thought right now?
Well, the audience we had in Vegas probably saw me a little hot under the collar when it came to the issue of municipal bonds.
That might be an understatement, David.
I thought I stayed pretty well in control, but municipal bonds, according to a Moody's study done in February, this was on tax-free municipalities, state and local municipalities, according to them, face no challenges ahead.
So Moody says, green light, go.
Yeah. So with peace in our hearts, let's see, calm returning to our nerves, we can know that Moody's, that venerable rating agency of mortgage-backed securities, credit default swaps, CLOs, CDOs, and other AAA-rated, quote-unquote, paper of the sort of 2005 to 2007 vintage, they've provided us with much-needed peace of mind.
Well, they do that fairly often, don't they?
The nagging question, perhaps unimportant, I ask, why is the cost of insuring against default in Illinois and California, these are the tax-free municipals, why is it higher than the same default insurance for beleaguered Spain and Portugal?
Wow.
So Southern Europe is in the 213 to 265 basis point range in terms of credit default swaps. Southern California and Illinois are 300 to 332 basis points. It costs more.
Wait,
the assumption is that there is a higher default risk in these states than in the pigs.
Than in Spain and in Portugal. So it costs me more to insure debt that I own in Illinois, California, tax-free municipal
but
bonds.
But Moody's has said there is no problem.
Yeah.
There is no future, not just present tense problem, Kevin, but no future problem with AAA rated paper.
I guess they need to tell the insurers or tell the market of the insurers of those CDOs that there is no problem.
And this is, again, going back to the efficient market hypothesis. If you look at the average price and yield of 20-year municipal bonds, you'll find that the Moody's conclusion is partially supported by the highest prices required to purchase munis, and the other side of that equation, the lowest yield in the last 30 years, coming in on average at about 3.48%.
Mm-hmm.
But someone's forgetting that there is an increase in services and a decrease in revenues at the same time, Kevin. That is only a realistic state of affairs if you're the federal government and have access to a printing press.
Yeah.
This is the world where money is as free as the air we breathe. But, Kevin, that is not the case with municipalities. In other words, deficit spending at the state and municipal level does ultimately have consequences, real-world consequences, and the probability of default in those municipalities is not priced in one iota into the price. How efficient are these markets?
Okay. Well, David, on July 28th, 2010, gold was around 1,080, and your father, Don McIlvaney, joined us for the program that day.
David, the bottom line is wealth is evaporating rapidly in the United States. Now, you think it's just the poor people. You think maybe it's just the middle class. It's really everybody. Now, you know that over 50% of the people in the United States pay zero taxes. So they're in a lower income tax bracket for sure. They pay no taxes. So if you're in the other 49 or so percent, you're paying for their taxes and your taxes too.
They get a vote too, right?
Oh, yes. They get to vote, and they vote for the politicians who will hand them the most money.
No, they would not vote their self-interest. Come on. I mean, surely they have to base their views on ideology, on truth. Everyone is pursuing truth, aren't they?
Okay. I got to give you a quote. Alexander Tyler said a couple hundred years ago that a democracy cannot exist as a permanent form of government. It will only exist so long until the politicians find that they can vote money from the Treasury and hand it out to the public to get more votes. Consequently, this is a paraphrase, the democracy always collapses over weak fiscal policy to be followed by a dictatorship. And he added that the average age of the world's great democracies has been 200 years.
Well, the good thing is we don't have weak fiscal policy, so that can't happen to us. I'm really glad you shared that with us.
Bottom line, wealth is evaporating. It's evaporating for the poor people. They never had it. The middle class is being squeezed and destroyed out of existence. It's going out of existence. We've got an upcoming article in our newsletter about it. It's just really scary. But the rich people, their wealth is also evaporating. It's the rich people. It's the people in higher tax brackets that are buying municipal bonds. They own a lot of real estate. They own stocks. They're also down. David, you and I know that we've gone down to Mexico, and we've talked to some extremely wealthy people over the last year or so, and we know that many of those people, these are people, many of them in the billionaire category, and many of them have seen their wealth shrink by as much as 50%. So what we're seeing is a massive collapse of wealth. Now, that's the bad news. There is other bad news, but that's some bad news. Okay, the real good news is that we have seen many people who have seen their wealth and their net worth increase because they had heavy positions in precious metals, either in their IRAs, their retirement funds, or whatever. And over the last 10 years, we've seen gold go from approximately 250 to over 1250, about a five-fold rise, while we saw the stock market on average drop 30%.
Okay, but the bond market is falling to pieces. We have too much debt in the system. We're watching deleveraging occur in front of our eyes. Gold is off of its peak of 1263, and it's below 1200 on its way to $300 an ounce, right?
I like to think that it's probably going to pull back a few more dollars, and I am so excited that gold has pulled back because it's an opportunity to buy more. Gold, we believe, will go to the 15, 16, 1650 range over the next 6 to 12 months because of the monetary financial problems we're talking about.
So we're not going to 300?
Not in our lifetime, I don't believe. By the way, one of the reasons I'm bullish on gold, it's not because Americans are buying gold. Americans and people in England, if any of you are listening to this, are brain dead when it comes to gold. Americans are dumb as a rock when it comes to understanding these things in gold. Not our listeners, not our readers for our newsletter. And so the average American, 98% of the American people are happy to be in a stock market that's down 30 or 20% over the last 10 years, and less than 2% of the people have gone into gold, which is up fivefold. But that's the bad news for America. You've got wealthy, sophisticated people in China. Yeah, it's the Chinese government. It's also the men on the street. In India, all over Asia, in the Middle East, and now in Europe, are buying gold like there's no tomorrow. That's one of the reasons gold will continue. This bull market in gold will continue for several more years, and will go maybe multiples of where we are now.
Just for perspective, every year between May and August, gold hits a low point. This is not a deflationary collapse in the price of gold. This is seasonally what has happened. I mean, we've been in the business for 40 years. This is what happens every year, with the exception of about 3 years in 40. This is when it happens. This is how it happens. This is what it looks like.
And this is an incredible opportunity.
September 15th, 2010, David, Giulio Gallarotti talked about how politics directly influences economic decisions at this point.
Kevin, and the point was that that changed dramatically after World War I and World War II. Let's go to that clip. Post-World War I and II, politicians were more involved in economic issues, developed a different agenda. What did suffrage have to do with that?
Well, suffrage was very, very important in politicizing economics. Again, before World War I, before the turn of the century, government really wasn't involved in economics. It became involved because suffrage was extended to the middle class and the lower middle class. As you know, before the turn of the century, voting was a very exclusive privilege. Not just anyone can vote, usually people of means. Very often you had to own property. So there wasn't universal suffrage, but when universal suffrage emerged around the turn of the century, then you could imagine that now politicians have catered to the interests and the needs of this new enfranchised class. And what do middle class and lower middle class groups want? Well, they're not interested in war, they're not interested in imperialism or the greater glory of the country. They're interested in jobs. They're interested in keeping jobs. And that's linked to the prosperity in the system. So they want a prosperous economy, jobs, and jobs that they can keep. So the fact that you now have this large voting bloc that's primarily interested in economic performance, politicians can't be laissez-faire anymore. They can't keep their hands off. In the 19th century, you weren't punished for adverse economic outcomes. And it's interesting, you see it in the statistics. If you look at statistics on business cycles, recessions were way longer before 1914. Well, well longer. I think in the developed world, the average length of a recession was something like 3 years, and the average expansion was something like 5 years. To put this in perspective, after World War II, among industrialized countries, the average length of a recession is less than a year, and expansions on average are closer to 9 years. So this is very indicative of a change, of a political change. Now, politicians, you know, they can't have recessions anymore. Even in this country, recessions are very rare. Since the mid-70s, we've had, maybe I can count the recessionary periods on my right hand. So things changed because of suffrage. Now you have classes that want to be protected. As a result, there's the rise of what I call the guardian state. I wrote an article about this, about how things changed politically. And because things changed politically, the economics changed as well. Now the state was intimately involved, and it changed the entire landscape. It changed all the relations. And as a result, it changed the monetary systems that emerged after the war. And it had an impact, a direct impact on each of the four characteristics defining monetary systems in a way that created far greater instability than stability.
It seems like, Giulio, with the rise of the guardian state, you also introduce an inflationary bias into monetary policy. And you know that clearly was inconsistent with the naturally corrective or deflationary cycle associated with the gold standard. So it can't operate when you have the need for sort of a mildly expansionary policy to accommodate fiscal policy that, again, is being directed more towards a politicized budget and a voting bloc that really does care about recessions and jobs and employment.
That's precisely true. And now, in a sense, what you've just said, fundamentally at the base of this, the fact that you can't really have, it's very difficult to have responsible monetary policy. But what I mean responsible is not sound money. It's very, very difficult. There are a lot of temptations to inflate. We've seen this all throughout the century, from moderate inflation to hyperinflation. Governments have to pay their bills. They're trying to undertake economic stimulus to create more jobs, more investment, and they do it by printing money.
Kevin, on September 29th, we had Richard Duncan on as a guest, and it seemed like he had been on the program before, but it's just because we've read his books before. Mm. And we do strongly recommend both The Dollar Crisis and The Corruption of Capitalism for our listeners. We'll go to that interview now. As an economist, maybe you could comment on that. What are they looking at versus what are you looking at that you would categorize as not only in a recession, perhaps a depression?
It's important to understand that this new depression, as I call it, came about really for exactly the same reason as the Great Depression did. The Great Depression originated in 1914, in my opinion, when all of the European nations went off the classical gold standard in order to finance World War One. At the beginning of World War One, the European nations broke the link between their currencies and gold so that they could issue enormous amounts of government credit they needed to use to finance the war. All of the credit created during that period led to the Roaring Twenties. It was a worldwide credit boom during the 1920s. In 1930, however, that credit couldn't be repaid. And at that point, the international banking system collapsed and international trade collapsed. Exactly the same thing has happened this time. This new depression originated because in 1971, the Bretton Woods system, which was more or less a gold standard, broke down. Afterwards, the United States started issuing enormous amounts of dollar-denominated debt to finance its government budget deficits and its trade deficits, and all of the credit that the U.S. issued sparked off a worldwide economic boom that lasted for 2 to 3 decades. But in 2008, the private sector couldn't repay that credit, and the international banking system collapsed, and international trade collapsed. So it's come about in exactly the same way. However, this time the policy response has been completely different. In the Great Depression, the policymakers believed very strongly that the government had to keep the budget balanced, and they did try as far as possible to maintain a balanced government budget. There were no Keynesian stimulus programs at that point. But this time around, they have completely adopted Keynesian policy, not only in the United States, but in every major government around the world, realizing that if the government doesn't spend enough money to continue stimulating the global economy, now that the private sector is cut off from any additional credit and the private sector is incapable of spending, if the governments do not step in, then the global economy would collapse into a 1930-style depression with a very significant contraction in the GDP and a return to 20 or 25% unemployment. So the policy response has been completely different this time. So coming back to your original question, when you say that the recession has been declared over, what everyone needs to be aware of is that we have a government budget deficit in the United States of approximately 10% of GDP. So last year, the U.S. economy contracted by roughly 2%. But had it not been for this $1.4 trillion budget deficit, equivalent to 10% of GDP, the U.S. economy wouldn't have just contracted by 2%. It would have contracted by minus 2, plus minus 10, minus 12, plus a multiplier. It really would have been a complete replay of the Great Depression with more than 20% unemployment. So it's difficult to say the recession is over when, in fact, the reality is that the U.S. economy and the global economy is on government life support. And without the support provided by these massive government budget deficits around the world and unorthodox monetary policy, then the global economy would actually be in severe recession, if not depression.
David, on October 27th, we were honored to talk to Jim Rogers. That was an interesting interview as well.
There is no question in my mind that the bull market in commodities is continuing. There's been very little productive capacity added for decades now, 30 years, 25 or 30 years. You know, the recent unpleasantness in the world, financial world, means that there's even less supply coming on stream. Many people who in 2007 or 2008 thought they might add capacity have changed their minds and not doing it. You know, they're all saying, see, we told you. We told you this was not going to last. So there's even less supply coming in the future. The commodities bull market is in continuance. If the world economy gets better, Dave, then you're going to make a lot of money in commodities because shortages are developing. If the world economy does not get better, we'll do better in commodities because they're going to print money. That's all they know how to do. Now, printing money is bad for the world, but, you know, the people at the central bank in the U.S., for instance, don't know any better. Mr. Bernanke spent his whole career studying the printing of money. So he will print even more money, as he's already said. So the commodities bull market has a ways to go. There is a currency problem developing. We have imbalances, great imbalances in the world economies. The U.S. is the largest debtor nation in the history of the world. The U.K. has gigantic debts. You know who and where the debtors are. Well, the creditors are mainly in Asia. The largest creditor nations in the world are China, Korea, Japan, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore. And usually this kind of imbalance gets sorted out in the currency market. So we're going to have more problems, more turmoil, I should say. The U.S. is a terribly flawed currency. I don't think anybody would dispute that. And it's getting worse. So the problems with in the currency markets and with the U.S. dollar are going to continue. There will be rallies in the dollar, no matter how bad things are. And there always are rallies in every bear market. But for the most part, people need to figure out how to play the currency markets because it's going to affect them. Many countries in the world are already saying, oh, we've got to do something about the dollar. You know, Brazil, China, Russia, I mean, lots of people are saying, oh, gosh, what do we do? And so that's going to be an ongoing problem. There is a shift in the world from the U.S. to Asia. That's another major trend that's taking place. I just got through saying the major creditors are all in Asia now. The major debtors are in the West. There is, in my view, there's a shift away from financial centers to the producers of real goods. We've had long periods in history when the financial types were in charge, in the center of everything. And then we've had shifts when the people who produced real goods, whether it was farmers or miners or lumberjacks or whatever, were in charge. That kind of shift in the 80s, 90s, and this decade, financial centers were in charge, and now it's shifting back to the producers of real goods.
Kevin, in late November, we had Ambrose Evans Pritchard on our program again, November 24th, to discuss Europe.
Nice to be with you. I mean, there's a basic point here. The original sin was to create this currency without a kind of unified treasury like the U.S. Treasury, without a kind of debt union, without an economic government or a single political entity behind it. It's an orphan currency with these separate sovereign states running their own fiscal policies. And you know, they got away with it for 10 years, but finally, incoherence of this has caught up with them. And huge imbalances were allowed to develop, as you know. Finally, it was exposed by the global financial crisis. The first country to erupt was Greece in April. They had a rescue, 110 billion euro rescue. They thought they'd put that to bed and they'd got through the crisis. And now, of course, it's erupted again. We've got a sort of second wave of this, and it's Ireland, and close behind Ireland is Portugal. And, you know, what is it exposing? It's not just a question of Greece having cheated and lied over its figures. There's a deeper problem that several countries are in serious trouble. And what they all have in common is far too much debt. And the reason why I have far too much debt is the interest rates set by the European Central Bank for German needs a decade ago caused them to have massive property and credit bubbles and overheat. So essentially trying to run a monetary policy for two completely different kinds of economies, essentially North Europe and South Europe, you know, for a slow core that needed very low rates and a very fast-growing core, a very fast-growing periphery that needed much higher rates is just incompatible and has led to the total mess we're now in. And I would add further, the way that the rescue fund works is like climbers on a glacier who are all roped together. Each time one of these countries needs a rescue, it's like somebody slipping on the glacier and falling and hanging on the rope, and there's a smaller and smaller group of solvent states holding the line. So you've got more and more people dangling on the line and less solvent states holding the line. So it's an unworkable arrangement. And so if you have an Irish and a Portuguese rescue, you're probably talking about $200 billion, euros. But Spain is having to contribute to this. So it's depleting Spain's public finances, making it worse. Now, what happened to Spain is a rescue, probably for $300-400 billion. Then you're talking about $500-600 billion, and then Italy's public finances get depleted because Italy has to pay for that. As soon as you think it through, it's not viable. And they created this rescue fund, this 750 billion euro shock and awe safety net with the IMF they created in May. They did it kind of, they cobbled it together on the spur of the moment, thinking their bluff would never be called. And simply announcing the existence of this safety net would be enough. And now, to their horror,
they've got to pay up.
It is being called. Ireland's calling it right now, and Portugal is just a step away. And this is the ultimate nightmare in Europe, that this thing just, they have to deliver, and then people find out this fund doesn't really exist. It doesn't exist in the sense that there is limited tolerance and patience in Germany and the Netherlands to fund these bailouts. And the more this goes on, the more that's going to be completely exposed. It will become clear that the German public will not accept any further bailouts and will not go beyond Spain. Absolutely, definitely not. And then you have a global systemic crisis. That's the danger point.
Well, David, I'll say this year, 2010, has been an amazing education. I'd like to just thank all the guests that we've had. It's a huge exploration in a lot of different types of questions. But, David, this show today is simply like a wine tasting. You know, you get a little sip of this, you get a little sip of that, but in reality, you really need to go back and buy the bottle.
Well, we end the year where we began, with more questions than answers, and we look forward to 2011 as we continue to pursue what is happening in the world and what are the implications. How can we have a better grasp of that? So, in anticipation, we thank our guests, both from last year and as they join us in 2011.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or you can always give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.